We have made it to the 10th lesson in the book of Judges, and we will hopefully be finishing it tonight in chapters 19 through 21. And after that, I'm thinking we might begin an afternoon series in 1 John. I'm not sure yet, but I feel like I need a little bit of a palate cleanser after the book of Judges. And as you can see, we have titled this series, The Dark Days of the Judges, because the days of the judges are very dark. And if you remember, when we started this series, we began with a prologue in the book of Judges. Chapters 1 and 2 is sort of like background information that helps set the scene for the stories in the book. And the book ends with an epilogue, chapters 17 through 21. And so both of those together are like the bookends for the main cycle of judges that we see over and over again. Those familiar stories of the saviors that God raised up to deliver his people from their enemies. And the epilogue basically contains two stories. Last time that we were together, we talked about Micah and the Danites in chapters 17 and 18. And again, tonight, we'll be looking at chapters 19 through 21, which we'll call the crime at Gibeah. And what we talked about last time that we were together is that the first story is like a story of religious relativity. When everybody does what's right in his own eyes as far as worship and religion is concerned, it gets real silly real fast. And we ended up with Micah and his worship center and this wandering Danite who ends up getting hired away by the Danites, and it's a very strange story. But this last story is a story of moral relativity. And again, it shows us what happens to morals when everybody just does whatever is right in their own eyes. And it's really hard to say exactly when these events take place. The organization doesn't appear to be chronological, but thematic. But these two stories together really illustrate what it looks like when everybody does what they think is right and how awful that is. And I'll say, before we get into this last story, that this last one is one of the most horrific stories in the whole Bible. It's a terrible one. But God has preserved it for us because he wants us to consider it. And he wants us to be confronted with just how bad things can be when we do what we think is right. So as we begin to look at our text, I'll begin by just sort of summarizing chapter 19, verses 1 through 15. The second story of this epilogue begins when another Levite, who's not living where he should be living, is traveling this time. And this Levite has a concubine. And a concubine is sort of like a wife without the legal privileges of being a wife. And he and his concubine are together, but she ends up having a disagreement with him. And she goes back to her father's house in Bethlehem. And so this Levite goes after her to try to get her to come back with him. And eventually he does convince her to leave with him. And they get this late start to their journey. And as they're traveling, it starts to get dark near a city called Jebus, which will eventually be called Jerusalem. But at this time, Jebus is a Canaanite city. And it's inhabited by Jebusites. And that's why it's called Jebus. And this Levite is uncomfortable spending the night there. He doesn't trust those ungodly foreigners. He'd rather push on a couple more miles to make it to an Israelite city. And so he heads to Gibeah in the tribe of Benjamin. And ironically, this decision does not turn out very well for him or for his concubine. So in verse 14, it says that they passed on and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Now, this last statement in verse 15 would be a startling statement anywhere in the ancient Near East. Hospitality was something that was just sort of expected, that when travelers came through, you would take them in and show them warmth. They didn't have Holiday Inns or Airbnbs, and they relied on the hospitality of strangers. But this is especially alarming that this happens in the nation of Israel, Because God had been very clear with his people that they were supposed to be hospitable to travelers, to sojourners. And so the fact that this Levite and his concubine stop at this city and no one takes them in to spend the night is a little bit of an unsettling sign of what's to come. And so hospitality appears to have been forsaken. Whether that was because of the Israelites' lack of regard for what God had said, or if it was because things were just so unsafe at these times that this is just the way people lived, or some combination of the two, the Levite and his concubine are not taken into stay. So let's begin reading here now in verse 16. Verse 16 says, "And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?' And he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys, with bread and wine for me and your female servant, and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything.' And the old man said, 'Peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square.' So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed. And they washed their feet and ate and drank." So the Levite and his concubine have no other options. They stop in the city and they're preparing to just sort of sleep out in the open square of the city that night, when this old man from Ephraim sees them. And he's concerned. And it seems sort of ominous, and it should, because he knows that if they spend the night out in the square, that really they're making themselves very vulnerable. And he tells them that that's not safe. But this story should also sound very familiar to us. To any of us who have really studied the Bible at all, you should be having some alarm bells going off in your head where you're like, wait a second. This sounds very similar to Genesis 19. And the fact is, Judges 19 is very similar to Judges 19. But what happened back in Genesis 19 is there were two angels who went to Sodom. And they were urged by Lot not to spend the night out in the open square. And Lot takes them into his house. And as this story begins to show us the similarities with Sodom, as the story goes on, it becomes even more similar, shockingly so. So let's read verses 22 through 30 to get the end of this story. "As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, 'Bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him.' And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing.' But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, 'Get up, let's be going.' But there was no answer. Then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife. And taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, 'Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak.'" Terrific, isn't it? It's really hard to find words that describe just how disgusting and depraved this story is. And there's nobody that's cast in a favorable light. The men of the city act exactly like the men of Sodom did back in Genesis 19, surrounding the house, beating on the door, demanding to be given the male traveler for their own perverted use. And the master of the house acts exactly like Lot, offering his own daughter to them instead, because apparently in his twisted mind, he thought that that was somehow favorable to what they were demanding. And the Levite offers his concubine to them, throws her out like a scrap of meat to the dogs. And the next morning scene is brutal. The Levite sees the woman lying at the threshold of the door and sort of coldly just says, okay, it's time to go, get up. And there's no answer. And so his reaction is to dismember her and send the 12 pieces to each of the 12 tribes. This is a disturbing story. The text tells us it's an outrageous thing. But this is a portrait of a nation that's rotting at its core. And the thing that was supposed to separate the Israelites from the Canaanites was their relationship with the Almighty God. They had a relationship with the Holy One of Israel. This nation of all nations was supposed to be a holy nation that was separate and different and set apart. And yet what we see is they have become just as bad or even worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. When you think about it, the book of Joshua is a conquest book. It tells us the story of how the Israelites came into the land of Canaan and conquered the people and overcame them. But the book of Judges is also a conquest book. Except this time, it's the Canaanites who overcome the Israelites. Spiritually, the Israelites have become just as wicked as them. They have succumbed to the evil all around them. Well, what can be done after something like this? As you move into chapter 20, we see in verse 1 that then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now, in all the book of Judges, nothing like this has ever happened before. Even when Deborah and Barak tried to get all the people together to fight against their enemies, never have we seen such a coordinated effort of all the nation of Israel working together. But now they're not assembled to fight against some foreign nation. They're assembled to fight against their own people. Civil war is breaking out with 11 tribes united against the one. And so in verse 8, it says, all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take 10 of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000, to bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. And what ends up happening in the rest of chapter 20 is we see the story of how this battle plays out. And there's some interesting details in it, but we'll just sort of summarize some of this. But there are great losses on both sides. In fact, if you go through the rest of chapter 20 and total up all of the deaths that occur at each one of these conflicts, there are tremendous losses on both sides, and it ends up being at least 65,000 people who are killed in this chapter alone. But by the end of it, the city of Gibeah meets the same fate that Sodom did. If you look at verse 40 of chapter 20, it says, when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. It's an interesting detail. That just as Gibeah had become the new Sodom, Gibeah ends like the old Sodom did, going up in a column of smoke. But what's even more significant than that is by the end of this chapter, The entire tribe of Benjamin is almost completely wiped out. There were tremendous losses on both sides, but Benjamin is left with almost nobody remaining. And when you get to verse 47, it tells us that there were only 600 men remaining in the tribe of Benjamin. And that leads to chapter 21, because now Israel has a very practical problem on their hands. They set out to punish Benjamin, and they wanted to take vengeance on them, and they even made vows that they would not give their sons or give their daughters to the men of Benjamin. But now, they're in danger of totally losing a tribe. If they don't do anything about it, they're going to be the 11 tribes of Israel and not the 12 anymore. So in chapter 21, in verse 1, it says, "Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, 'O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel, that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel?' And the next day the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, 'Which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly of the Lord?' For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, 'He shall surely be put to death.' And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin their brother and said, 'One tribe is cut off from Israel this day.'" So again, in verse 7, "What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives?" So again, Israel has this dilemma. Benjamin is down to just 600 men. They've taken this vow that they're not going to give their daughters to the ones that are remaining. And so it seems like they're caught between this rock and a hard place. Either they go back on their vow, or they let the tribe of Benjamin become extinguished. Now, that leads them to beginning to consider their solution. And notice that the solution that is put forth is really not that much better than the problem. Judges 21 in verse 8. "And they said, 'What one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord, to Mizpah?' And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, 'Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male you shall devote to destruction.' And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan." Okay, so are you following this? They say, okay, we can't go back on our vow. We don't want the tribe of Benjamin to be extinguished. So let's try to find somebody that didn't get caught up in this conflict. And they look around and they find this one city, Jabesh-Gilead, where they were sort of like Switzerland in this whole thing. They just kind of stayed out of it. And so they say, let's go to them and we'll attack them. We'll just exterminate men, women, and children. And as many virgins that we can find, we'll just take them and we'll take them and give them to the people of Benjamin. What kind of sense does that make? It's horrific. The solution is worse than the problem. But if you noticed, there's still 200 women short. The solution is eerily similar to the very problem that started this whole mess. The men of Israel are murdering and violating innocent people, just like the people of Gibeah had done back in chapter 19. But as I mentioned, there's still 200 women short. And so in verse 13, it says, "Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, but they were not enough for them. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel." So, just when you think that things can't get any worse, watch how the nation of Israel finds these last 200 women. Verse 16. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the people of Israel had sworn, 'Cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin.' So they said, 'Behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Lebanon.' And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, 'Go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty.' And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives according to their number from the dancers whom they carried. Then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family, and they went out from there, every man to his inheritance." Not exactly they lived happily ever after, you know. I mean, if you've been reading this book, you've been seeing how there's just been these cycles over and over again, and there are these promising signs sometimes where it seems like that the people are turning to God, and maybe this time they're actually going to repent, but every time they dip lower and lower and lower, and at the end of the story, it's just like there's no redeeming how far that they've gotten. And so the idea that the people have is, well, we know about this festival that happens at Shiloh. And every year, the women go out and dance, so here's what we'll tell the people of Benjamin to do. You just hide in the bushes, and when you see the women going out to dance, you just snatch some wives for yourself and throw them over your shoulder and haul them back to Benjamin. Just take them. That'll be fine. And, you know, when their fathers and brothers complain to you, just say, "Well, we didn't attack you to take them, and you didn't just give them to us, so technically, we're kind of both innocent. Let's just let it go." And maybe the most shocking thing in the whole story is that it works. I mean, like, they do the thing, and the fathers and brothers come out, and they just say, like, "Hey, you should just let us go." And they're like, "Fine." And everybody just goes back to their lives, as if this is somehow sensical in any way. But it's madness. And that's the point. That's the point. Verse 25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." That's the theme of the book of Judges. That's the thing that the writer wants us to be impressed with. That's the anthem that's repeated four times in this epilogue section. Is that when everybody does what's right in their own eyes, it's disastrous. The fact that there's no king, I think, is not just a reference to the fact that this is before Saul and David and Solomon took the throne. But it's underlining the fact that there's no authority at all in Israel. No divine authority. It was God who should have been their king, and they refused to listen to him. And so there is no standard of right and wrong. Nothing makes sense. There's only darkness and depravity. And again, that is the terrible end of the book that we're supposed to just meditate on. But what kind of applications can we take from these last few chapters? Well, number one, I think that this is an important literary thing in the book of Judges, is it wants us to see how religious relativity always leads to moral relativity. Remember that first story in chapter 17 and 18 about Micah and the Danites and his worship center that he set up leads into the second story in chapters 19 through 21 that we've just considered. The first story is a story of religious relativity, the second one of moral relativity. And the point is that when religious truth is abandoned, moral truth is abandoned too. When we stop caring about what God has said, we just stop caring about what God has said. Whether that has to do with the way that we worship, the way that we think about him, the way that we talk about him, or the way that we treat other people who are made in his image. If we don't care about what God has said, it leads to this kind of thing. But isn't this at the heart of sin itself? If you go to Genesis chapter 3, it also makes me think about the very first sin that we see committed in the Bible. And you remember that in Genesis 3 and verse 1, we're introduced to the serpent. And it says that the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So just stop there. Notice that there is this like religious relativity going on where the serpent says, "Did God actually say that you shouldn't eat of any tree in the garden?" That's not what God said. God said that there is this one tree that you shouldn't eat of, and if you do eat of it, that you'll die. And the serpent just sort of changes that slightly, and he says, "You will not surely die." Isn't that the way that religious relativity tends to creep in? Small changes, one word, one little thought. He puts that in Eve's mind, and look at what ends up happening in verse 6. "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eye, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate." Much like the nation of Israel, Eve decides to do what is right in her eyes. The religious relativity of the serpent leads to the moral relativity that she acts on. And as we've been seeing in our Wednesday night class in the book of Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The way that we can know what's right and wrong, the way we can make decisions that are wise and righteous, is to learn to trust God more than ourselves. To do what he says, even if we don't understand or if it doesn't make sense to us. We have to learn to trust him more than we trust us. And when we start to walk by the sight of our own eyes and not his, we begin to walk on a very dark path. But a second lesson that I think we can see in this last story in Judges is that when God's people are unfaithful to him, they're no different than the rest of the world. It's really disturbing how evil the holy nation of Israel had become. Like we've pointed out, they've become just as bad as Sodom and Gomorrah. And the truth is, we might know a lot more about God than the wicked people of this earth do. We might know a lot more of the Bible than the world does. We may go to church more than the Bible does, or more than the world does. But none of that means anything if we're not actually being faithful to what God has said. There are a lot of religious people who are hypocritical and self-righteous. Let's not be one of them. In Romans chapter 1, Paul points this thing out about the Jews' mentality. And I think it's really fitting for us to think about in this context. Romans chapter 1 and verse 19. He says, "If you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." And so again, if we are not faithful to what God has said, none of our religious activity means anything. And we can actually do a lot of counterproductive things for the glory of God. But number 3, We need to seek heavenly solutions to our earthly problems. As we've mentioned, the events of chapter 19 are horrific. I mean, it's just unthinkable, the kinds of things that happened there in Gibeah. But the solutions that they came up with in chapters 20 and 21 are just as bad. And both of those decisions were produced by their worldly wisdom. There may be times in our lives when we encounter terrible circumstances. It might be because there are consequences of our own sins and our own foolish choices. But other times we might encounter hard circumstances that are just hard circumstances, just things that happen. But regardless, the solution for us is always to look up. We will not solve any of our earthly problems by merely earthly means. Earthly wisdom will often just dig a deeper hole. But we need to have the humility to seek the wisdom from above. And so whether we're dealing with financial hardships, health struggles, challenges to our relationships, church difficulties, God is the one who will help us see things with the right perspective. And God is the one who will guide us to respond in righteousness. And so, if we want to avoid the darkness of the book of Judges, the lesson is, don't do what's right in your eyes. Make Christ the king of your life and walk by faith in him. Trust him enough to do what he says. Trust him enough to act on what he says is good, not on what you think is good. And when you make that decision, you're on a path that is bathed in light and grows ever brighter until full day. And that is the message that I think that we should conclude with in the book of Judges, is that if we want to avoid the darkness of this book, there is light in the Son of God. And that is the invitation that I want to end with this evening as well. That if you want your life to be filled with light, a life that can be bright instead of dark, a life that can be blessed instead of cursed, a life that proclaims the glory of God instead of bring shame upon his name, you can make that decision today before you leave. If there's anybody here that needs any help spiritually, we want you to know that God would be so pleased if you would make that right with him. And if there's any way that we can help you with that, we would like to offer ourselves to you as well. Come to the front. Let us know how we can help while we stand together and sing.